The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI for more information.
Hey, this is Wes Alwyn here. For PEL fans who live in the Boston area, I'm giving a talk on philosophy, psychoanalysis, and the film Ex Machina on December 1st. For more information, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/Ex Machina, or to get a ticket, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/tickets.
You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 127 is something like, what's the relationship between experience and the world? And we read John Dewey's Experience and Nature, chapters 1 through 4, from 1925. Join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer, hoarding terminal qualities in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Alwyn, sequentially ordered in Boston, Massachusetts.
Take your time.
This is Dylan Casey in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Oh.
That was just terrible.
You have rendered subject distinct from object, Dylan. You're no longer an unanalyzed totality.
So, John Dewey, what'd y'all think?
I got the sense, Mark, that you were not enjoying it, but I think he's a great writer, even though it's difficult, it's dense, and it's packed full of insights. I mean, as you guys probably anticipated, I disagree with the fundamental theory, but you cannot deny that it's so insightful. It's impressive.
I'll be interested to hear the disagreement.
Well, it's just the typical disagreements about whether this really can avoid being a man is the measure of all things or a relativistic account.
So John Dewey, known for his pragmatism, known also for his theories about education, which are very much in line with what we read here. This is a later work. I mean, he lived to be 92, so there's plenty of work after this, but he was already in his 60s at this point, 1925. And he started writing when he was a Hegelian, like in the 1880s, and then wrote his pragmatism stuff around the same time as William James, around 1900. And then the big book, Democracy and Education, was 1915.
Yep.
So 1925, this is his mature work of metaphysics.
By the way, he was accused of this being like a crypto-Hegelianism.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Huh.
Yes. That was part of his background.
I mean, I've thought this about pragmatism too for a long time. It's hard to...
It's crypto-Hegelianism?
It comes out of neo-Kantianism, and it's even though they try and kick off that scaffolding, their inheritance. I said them during a pragmatism podcast that it kind of walks this fine line between relativism and idealism, but I've never understood how it avoids being one of those two. But again, I don't want to drag us into that right now.
So the word pragmatism doesn't show up in here at all, I believe.
It does. It shows up once. And not as pragmatism, but as pragmatic. It's in the second chapter, I think.
I find four instances in the whole book doing my search.
Oh, you have a...
You and your crazy electronic books.
Open, just the one that you sent us that we'll share with the people. I took my notes on that.
Now I ordered the book and I can't do electronic anymore.
And the one instance on page 109 of the word pragmatism is not using it like pragmatism, the philosophical theory. It's knowing that consequences will take care of themselves if conditions can be had and managed. An ineradical natural pragmatism indulges in a cheap and short conversion. Doesn't matter if we know what that means right now, but...
Did you find pragmatic?
I don't think our page numbers are the same. Sorry.
Huh.
That's odd. I thought this was like fixed. A fixed and rigid metaphysical.
Mark, what's the last page number in chapter 4?
I have the same version you have. It's 165.
You don't, because it's 137 for Wes and me, I think, right?
No, mine is 165.
165? What version do you have?
I mean, they're all the second. It's the second edition.
Yeah. I have the other one that's the Paul Karras lectures at the top.
Yep.
Maybe mine, it starts the page numbering not from the preface, but from the chapter one.
Yeah, as does ours. And actually, it's funny just because, and I think he must have been conscious about this, because the second version of it had a new chapter one, mm-hmm. some modifications that he talks about in the preface. And so chapter one actually starts on page 1A, and it goes through 4A, and then it starts over with 1, just to make the number of pages line up with his volume one, I believe.
Oh, mine doesn't do that at all.
That is very anal.
Yeah, I didn't know why that was done.
Huh, that's weird. I guess it's just different publishers. Mine's the Open Court version.
Dover Publications.
Yeah.
Even when we're not dealing with a foreign language text, we still have these issues. But at least we can blame all the wording on John Dewey himself. I found his style had a lot of fun things in it, but felt that each of these chapters, so we only read the first four, the whole book is over 400 pages, but even just the first four was up to 165 pages plus the preface. I just thought each of those chapters had a point in it that could be summed up, and he does even sum them up, in about two sentences.
Yeah, it's very repetitious. It's kind of disorganized, too, because I went through the exercise of trying to summarize it, and then you realize, oh, my God, he's jumping all over the place. And
is it because they were lectures, or at least based on lectures? Because the intro says it's the Paul Karras Foundation lectures that were intended to be published then after...
Someone sat through...
They're really freaking long, these chapters.
And dense. It seems to me more like well-crafted writing, despite the repetition and the...
All right, so we've said it has something to do with pragmatism. People might not even know what pragmatism means. We did an episode before on pragmatism. The specific term that he does use instead of pragmatism in chapter four more, when he's talking about science, is instrumentalism. Initially, his big issue is that philosophy, and he really generalizes about philosophy and talks about the problem with philosophy, is if all, even the seemingly contradicting points of view of the different philosophical schools, they all have made this mistake of basically, it's what Whitehead in that episode we did earlier this year called the bifurcation of nature, right? Between the world and mind.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think that mistake, though, is he thinks it's predicated on some other mistakes. And I think that's why he starts out with this idea that experience is double-barreled, or it contains this unanalyzed totality. So this is on page 8. He's privileging what we think of as sort of our naive everyday experience of objects like chairs and tables. That's sort of the anchoring point for the whole thing, where you have to see these things as the immediate and real things, and then you branch out from there. Whereas traditional philosophy has, at the time he's writing, it's gotten to the point where those are just phenomena, those are just appearances, and there's some underlying reality that accounts for those appearances, whether it's, you know, for the ancients, some sort of form, or whether for modern materialists, it's, oh, the chair is really just atoms and space and blah, blah, blah. He's rejecting all of that. He's going to object to anything which bifurcates appearance and reality in that way. The subject-object problem sort of arises out of that bifurcation of appearance and reality.
A big part of that is, I think he blames all of philosophy for not accepting things that are transitory as having being, of focusing far too much on essentially fixed things and saying that only those things have being, and anything that's transitory doesn't have being.
Right.
Yeah, that's his account of the selective emphasis, where we sort of take these epistemic values. We value unity, we value order and stability, these things that we want to achieve with inquiry, and we think of them as just already given. What is real is just the unified and the stable. So you get these fixed forms, for instance, in Platonic metaphysics that never change, despite the fact that the world that we experience is full of flux and instability.
He points to the partisans of flux and say that they end up essentially romanticizing it and making it into its own fixed thing, and that they, you know, sort of fall off the reservation as far as he's concerned.
Yeah, Heraclitus and Bergson, who try to sort of honor change, he thinks, they don't really get there. But,
And he also has a lot of sympathy for it. He considers it ultimately useful to focus on things that are the way in which they're fixed. But he thinks it's, you know, sort of an accident of our own temporality and our own sort of time scale, what things we pick to be fixed and what things we pick to not be fixed. And that we need to understand everything is really being events, regardless of whether they seem to be fixed or not, because the fact is that none of it's fixed.
we're still at a high-level summary here.
Yep.
We've thrown out the problem that he sees, and then you start giving the solution. Wes already gave part of the solution, too, which is acknowledging that experience is a double-barreled word. Now, what that means is that the experience of the table is not just the table part. It's also the experiencing part.
Mm-hmm.
So what Husserl called noesis and noema, if that's helpful, but it will not be helpful to most people.
Oh, my God.
That we might want to say immediately, okay, of course, there's the table, the objective thing, and then there is the way that we experience it. But that's the bifurcation of nature. That's the problem right there. It says, no, experience of table is one thing. It's just like, to bring in another comparison, the being in the world was given a hyphen by Heidegger to show that somehow the being and world were not fundamentally separable.
And I think we should read the way he puts this. It's sort of I see it as the whole premise. I mean, I know it's the solution, but it's also really where he starts from. Once you get this assumption down, I think so on 4A, for instance, at the very bottom, it is not experience which is experienced, but nature, stones, plants, animals, diseases, health, temperature, electricity, and so on. Things interacting in certain ways are experience, and they are what is experienced. Linked in certain other ways with another natural object, the human organism, they are how things are experienced as well. So I think that's a pretty strong statement of the sort of unity of nature and experience.
And he's going to bite the bullet. This is one of the most problematic parts, and I don't know that we can treat it properly here because apparently there's another paper on this. But if you want to say, for instance, that experience is scary, he actually is still going to say, that's actually scary as a thing out in the world just as much as color or shape or anything else. There's no grounds for that Locke making the distinction between secondary qualities that are in the head and primary qualities are in the world. Well, if he fundamentally does not want to separate head and world, that the head is just part of the world. You think of something, then your thinking of that is an event that goes on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So can I read another quote for this just because it's also so important? On 12, near the bottom, it is a notorious fact that one who hates finds the one hated an obnoxious and despicable character. To the lover, his adored one is full of intrinsically delightful and wonderful qualities. The connection between such facts and the fact of animism is direct. So he's favorably comparing animism to his own theory. The natural and original bias of man is all toward the objective. And what he means by the objective here is the idea that even these things like hate and love, which, as Mark was saying, we're used to thinking of as just in our heads, but no, the object in experience itself is hateable or lovable.
And so, of course, he has to give then some kind of explanation for instance, when you're wrong about something. You hear a noise and it's loud and scary, but then you turn on the light and you realize it was just, you know, your furniture bumping around or something. He still wants to say that the noise itself, when it happened, was loud and scary. That's just part of the world. And you then discovering more about it is just undertaking some experimentation, some interaction with the world. And that's how things work, is you actually modified the situation. You made it no longer scary by turning on the light and checking things out.
That sounds completely sensible. Explain a little bit why that doesn't sound sensible.
That scariness is in the thing in itself?
Well, scariness is in the event.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
The subject, object, event is combined. And
it seems to me that when you say something like the scariness is in the event, it seems like it's a little bit pejorative compared to what he's saying. The scariness is in the event and that unified experience between you and the world. And that is one thing. And to say, oh, Dewey's saying that that scariness is a real thing in the table. That's not what he's saying at all.
That's making the same mistake, that way of putting it, that he's accusing, is that all of philosophy makes. This is fundamentally a problem with our language.
Yep.
We're so used to thinking in this way. He says, thinking of mind and body as two sides of the same object, like convex and concave, is something that is literally unthinkable to us. But yet, if we understand things correctly, that's how it should be. It's part of the same phenomenon.
Yeah.
We have to unthink these mental habits.
Yes. And in fact, when you start going down the road of what we were just calling so absurd, he says, yes, it's absurd. And it's a sign that the way you're doing philosophy is absurd, that you're making a mistake. That's one of the signs of the failures of philosophy.
The intuition that's not absurd, I think, is that there's some mind-independent reality. You can sort of, from the beginning, say, well, we're going to look at things from the perspective of the mind as a natural part of reality. And then, so I'm not thinking about the relation of the subject to object. I'm looking at nature from on high, and I look at these subject-object dyads, which haven't been split apart, and call those the facts, instead of treating the facts as outside of the subject, and then the subject has to somehow relate to them. I think there are a lot of complicated problems that actually arise from that, about whether that gives you a sufficient level of mind independence, or whether that implies something mind independent outside of the realm of experience. What anchors, for instance, different agreement about things of different subject-object dyads, or their disagreement. The fact that the broccoli on the table in my event is good and in yours event is bad, and things like that. I didn't say it was absurd, but I don't think it's an obvious home run to make these types of assertions.
So you might think, in Dewey's language, what is this thing that unifies experience? This thing that the table in particular, when you and I look at it, it's the same thing. Well, he wants to go with the naive common sense answer as much as possible, that there actually is in our experience and thus in metaphysics, since experience is of the world and of the real world. It's a table. A table is a thing. It is partially in experience because we are experiencing parts of it, but he's not going to deny the phenomenological fact that there are parts of it that are outside any particular person's experience at any time. But he just doesn't think that there a metaphysical problem comes with that.
The other thing is that the table is no more privileged as a part of your experience than your dream about the table. And it just has a different relationship to other experiences than the dream about the table. So there's no metaphysical privileging of this is real and the dream is illusory, except in some functional sense of illusory. But go ahead.
Yeah, but that functional sense is really important. When you say something like, well, there's no privileging the distinction between the dream of the table and the table itself, and trying to imply that therefore you can't distinguish dreams from reality.
That's not what I'm trying to imply. I'm not attacking Dewey yet.
Well, and he's not really clear about this. He talks a little bit about illusions. He doesn't talk about dreams that I recall. You know, about illusions, he says, well, the fact that the illusion happened is a fact.
Yes.
So how do we apply that to, you're talking about the table? Well, it's just that, is our ontology going to have a dream table in it? I mean, I suppose, but that's going to be clearly different than the real table, what we call real, because we mutually interact with it. They have different instrumental capability.
Well, that's the functional part.
Yes, exactly.
So that you wake up from the dream and you don't have any other set of experiences that's causally related to it. You can't walk back into the dream and sit at the table and all sorts of things like that. So again, functionally, there's a distinction. But what's interesting here is that most of us are conditioned to think this way, of this sort of underlying reality that we have thoughts and feelings about, where we might be wrong. They might not match up to reality. And that's sort of this kind of three-dimensional way of looking at things, where appearance is sort of above and the reality is below. This is all flattened out. So everything that was once distinguished by this three-dimensional view is now sort of flattened out and becomes functional within that domain of appearance or experience.
He is going to refuse to say the sifting of things for being truthful is going to be correspond directly to them saying, well, all those illusions, they don't have being, and all those things that are real, they have being. He's going to refuse to sift things in those directions.
Well, so the way he does sift things is that the primary distinction that he makes in here is between primary experience and the secondary objects of reflection.
Yep.
So this immediately raises many more questions than it answered for me.
Those are definitively not real, the secondary objects of reflection.
So those include, for instance, scientific laws.
Yes.
They include concepts. They really include anything that can be known or thought.
They include atoms. They include scientific models. They're not to be reified. They're not to be seen as these things that underlie the appearances that you somehow grasp through your inquiry. They're to be seen as these ways of regulating experience.
Yes. Ways of regulating experience. Yep.
Again, you have to sort of think in this flattened out way of the way they will change a sort of causal sequence for us. They produce fulfillments for us in the sense of It could be even just satisfying our curiosity. And then they also create new inquiry for us. So they're tied to experience in this important way, but they're not themselves metaphysically real.
Just to try to make this concrete, what does this mean in terms of the table? That I guess the table as a concrete object is, you know, part of our primary experience, that we all are able to see it and touch it and to say, oh, well, it's not really real. It's a theoretical, you know, like Quine, who says that all objects are theoretical entities like atoms, that even macroscopic objects, well, all we really have are a bunch of perceptions. And then underlying that, we can theorize that there must be some object there that unifies it. That's not Dewey's position at all. He has to say that the table as an object is actually part of our experience. But calling it a physical object, calling it material, seems to involve some theory, seems to involve it being a secondary object of thought.
Yeah, he wants to avoid calling it either material or ideal. He wants to avoid the two sorts of metaphysical options, the materialist or the idealist.
But even just classifying it as opposed to a brisk wind as something that's going to stick around, we expect, until somebody breaks it or moves it or whatever. Is that not itself at least a rudimentary piece of theory that is experience is theory laden, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Well, he himself says that experience is theory laden, right? So.
Yeah, he's a, yeah.
So how do we make sense of that? Put that together with his claim that primary experience is ineffable. As soon as we start to talk about it, and as soon as we could have genuine knowledge about it, then we're already getting out of that realm into this realm of secondary objects. It just seems maybe that the line between primary experience and the secondary objects is not a very sharp one, which might be completely fine with him.
It seems like he wouldn't say that the table is possible to experience as a table with essentially an embeddedness and a theory about it and its functionality.
Yeah, because remember, one of the interesting things about science is that it's actually, this is the way in which it's theory laden, it's transformative. So our experience is actually changed by these non-real scientific objects. That's part of what they're good for, is the way they change our experience. That doesn't make the new experience that's been changed, that doesn't make that theoretical, right? The theory part is about this relations. Let me find the place where you, so on 21, for instance, or is it 21 or no, 11. So science is for a matter of instrumentalities for dealing with conditions of life and action. And then later he'll talk about it as the empirical method as a means of regulation of experience. So science is directed towards these causal sequences. It's directed towards the relationships between experiences. But the direct experiences themselves, while they may be transformed by that, they aren't themselves theoretical entities.
We can characterize what Chapter 4 tells us. The application of science to these things is by turning something that would have been just an object of aesthetic appreciation, just something that you notice and you groove on, into a symbol of something else, into a means. So the way he puts it is that in primary experience, everything just shows up as an end. But what he really just means that is the end of whatever process it was that produced it, which is a weird way of talking, is something that shows up. When you sort of think in a sophisticated way about it, by thinking of the table, not just as something that I'm looking at, but as something that I can use, as something that can mean something else, I begin to think about it as a physical object and think about the fact that seeing a surface means that there could be something under it, that it's made of wood, and so I could burn it. It becomes, through the application of these scientific ideas, I know it seems rudimentary to think this can be burned as a scientific idea, but just really any time you're investigating a potential change, that's when you're sort of flexing the rudimentary muscles of science. Then something is being converted, I think, to a secondary project.
Yeah, you're saying if I do this, then what will happen? It's potentialities.
Right. That involves those secondary objects, bringing them into primary experience and changing the primary experience so that something was an end becomes a means, a potential means.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So go ahead, Dylan.
Well, no, I was just going to say that, I mean, maybe this is a little bit later on, but this points to the way in which he wants to keep part of classical teleological thinking, but not against modern empirical philosophy, but not keep it all the way in sort of a Aristotelian sense. He thinks that it's clear that there are potentialities that are to be spoken of and sequences of causes, sequences of events that And that's the way to understand cause, is basically Hume. And that process goes a long way in the direction of teleological thinking, that things have ends.
We're kind of jumping forward with this, yeah, but he wants to keep the aesthetic. The problem with the ancient Greek thought is it identified the aesthetic with the object of rational knowledge,
yep,
which you grasp in this aesthetic way. Knowledge is actually, again, has to do with these causal sequences,
mm-hmm,
which are not metaphysical entities, even atoms. And so the aesthetic is reserved for this primary object of experience. And when he says aesthetic, by the way, he's thinking broadly. Where's that great quote where he gives you examples of all the things that he could mean by aesthetic? Do you remember that? Like relaxing your limbs after you've exerted yourself?
I mean, I know he says repeatedly that describing something as aesthetic doesn't mean it's beautiful. It's just something that has a qualitative feel.
Well, it's an immediate and absorbing finality. So on page 81, or actually it's on 80, a passion of anger, a dream, relaxation of limbs after effort, swapping of jokes, horseplay, beating of drums, blowing of tin whistles, explosions of firecrackers, and walking on stilts have the same quality of immediate and absorbing finality that is possessed by things and acts dignified by the title of aesthetic. So this is this broad sense of aesthetic that he's using, and it really even includes the normative, you know, when I, in general, which is the aesthetic is sort of part of the normative, but I mean the moral. When I'm making any sort of evaluative claims about objects, that's what he's talking about here.
Well, maybe we better at least outline what the four chapters were about to then start sinking into this a little more deeply. So chapter one, philosophic method. So that's where he's laying out. He calls it empirical naturalism or naturalistic empiricism. He does not care which one you use, mm-hmm, because they mean the same thing. That's the whole point about empirical having to do with experience, naturalism having to do with nature. That it might seem weird to talk about empirical naturalism because, well, naturalism has to do with science, it has to do with material things, but empirical is what you're experiencing. And no, what we experience is just wispy phantoms, and those are somehow related to underlying nature. No, 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 no. The whole point of that is just to stuff those two things together, to talk about what Whitehead called the bifurcation of nature.
Once you've made experience double-barreled like that, that sort of forms the basis for a philosophical method that's similar to the method of the natural sciences. Every reflective method sort of draws from primate experience. It uses raw experience as its data. But the distinctive thing about science is that it returns to experience.
And uses experience to refine what you were thinking.
Basically, it returns to experience to test the model, the theory, mm-hmm, that we have. And then the return to experience is also reflected in this idea of enrichment that I mentioned. So the primary experience changes by virtue of the path or method by which the return was made. Another way of saying that is that I look at the table differently once I know about atoms. Or mm-hmm, my primary experience of the moon, just as this phenomenon, this immediate thing, is transformed by knowing that it's a body that revolves around the Earth as opposed to part of a celestial sphere, something like that.
One thing we haven't mentioned that's brought up at the beginning and throughout all four chapters is the way in which our thinking about the world is part of dealing with the struggle of being alive and the fact that we need to make decisions and choices to rationalize the world and make it possible to live. And it's both the good things in the world and the things that we suffer through that we have to deal with. It's in my edition, it's on page 26. It's near the end of chapter one. This issue, like having a planet or whatever, he characterizes it in terms of invariance. Is we can deal with the variable and the precarious only by means of the stable and the constant. Invariance, in quotes, for the time being, are as much a necessity in practice for bringing something to pass as they are in mathematical functions. So, you know, we were talking earlier about events and the kind of transitory nature of them that he wants to emphasize, that even for things that seem constant, that that's a bit of a myth, but partly a myth that we bring to it through our philosophy, not denying that the invariance that we pick, that we say, well, the table is something that's invariant, or atoms are something invariant, that those invariants are there as part of rationalizing the world and making the variable, the precarious, understandable by referring to things that are stable and constant, at least stable and constant for some amount of time or in some perspective.
That is the theme of chapter two. He brings it up in chapter one, but then all of chapter two is about that existence as precarious.
Yeah.
That existence is full of risk. The world is scary, objectively. I mean, this explains why we come up with the secondary, whenever we come up with these abstractions, and he says it's a matter of choice, how we abstract from primary experience. And choice doesn't mean just like arbitrary, da-da-da, I'm going to do this today. Especially when we're talking about these things, why did we break up the world into physical objects in the way that we do? Well, because of the instrumental purposes we find they serve. What does instrumental purposes mean? Well, they help us ultimately to keep alive. He was very influenced by Darwin, and he wants to give a kind of evolutionary take on, that's what functionalism kind of means to him.
But we should say instrumental will have a much broader meaning.
But he means it in the starkest possible sense in this section.
Right.
So that the dangerousness of the world is ultimately what gives rise to all intellection, all creating of these secondary reflective things, everything really that pushes culture forward. But it also has led to philosophers, and he sounds very much like Nietzsche here. I really read him throughout this, especially at the beginning, as how Nietzsche will not even argue against views sometimes. He'll just make imputations about the people's motives in having the philosophy in the first place.
There's a lot of genealogy in here.
Yes.
So he's trying to say why philosophers get it wrong, and really it's a psychology of why we make these errors.
Hey, before we go any further, let's talk about our sponsor this time.
This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by the St. John's College Graduate Institute. The Graduate Institute is the master's degree granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Annapolis, Maryland. Most of you listening are dedicated to the thoughtful reading of and serious conversation about the greatest books ever written. The Graduate Institute attracts a community of fellows who are passionate about the life of the mind. All classes at the St. John's Graduate Institute are, like PEL episodes, discussions. The books of the teachers and the faculty members are tutors who come together to learn as well. The Graduate Institute accepts applications on a rolling basis. There's no application fee, and the only requirement is a bachelor's degree in any field. In addition to degree-granting programs, the Graduate Institute at St. John's College sponsors summer educational opportunities, including a 9-week Ancient Greek Institute, an 8-week film studies program, and 2-week-long Science Institute programs. So, if you're a PEL citizen, fan, or even a casual listener with an interest in joining other like-minded individuals in a more formal, intimate setting to engage in the serious contemplation of great works of literature, philosophy, history, theology, mathematics, and science, check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. Thanks to St. John's College Graduate Institute for their support of the Partially Examined Life.
We're also supported this time, the Grade Courses, our engaging video and audio lectures taught by top professors, perfect for all of us who love to learn. Now, there's a big overlap, I think, between people who listen to this podcast and folks that like other cultural stuff, like classical music. And we recently watched the Grade Courses collection on music's great masters, Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, and Tchaikovsky. There's a course on each of them. Each lecture series has 8 45-minute episodes, and they're really damn interesting. I listened to a big chunk of the one on Tchaikovsky and got a lot of insight into where the music was coming from, his tortured personal life, how it influenced the intensity and rich melodic beauty in his music. That's just one of many. They've got many things in philosophy. They've got stuff in religion, history, and more. As one of our listeners, you get a special deal from the Great Courses. If you order one of these 4 Great Masters courses, it's just $9.95, which is crazy. Less than $10 for 6 hours of fascinating content, and you'll feel smarter. You'll be able to impress people that you know cultural things now, whereas philosophy knowledge impresses no one.
Because they do not know what the fuck you're talking about.
But classical music knowledge, everybody at least thinks they understand that, so that's okay.
And they deliver that to you on these little round discs, right?
Oh, yes. They're available as DVDs, digital streaming, or downloads with the Great Courses apps. The special price of $9.95 is only available for a limited time, so order today by going to thegreatcourses.com/PEL. That's thegreatcourses.com/PEL.
Hey everyone, this is Nathan Hanks with updates on Knot School. There are new proposals. If you're looking to read Consciousness Explained by Daniel Dennett, The Theory of the Novel by George Lukacs, or Homo Sacer by Giorgio Agamben, chapters 4 and 5, then go to the Citizens Forum and put some sway behind those groups. They're looking for members to join and start the conversation. If you want to propose your own, of course you can, or maybe even start a topic in the Citizens Forum for a more casual conversation. If you have any questions or ideas about Knot School, contact me. That's Nathan at partiallyexaminedlife.com. Thank you for listening.
All right, let's get back to the discussion.
Think back to our Augustine episode. So Augustine is a great foil for most of this book because he just explicitly says anything that is transient can't be relied on, not ultimately real. The only thing that is real would have to be a permanence, would have to be God, something that transcends, exists outside of the experienced world. And so that then debases, of course, anything that you actually do experience, because that could at best be a shadow. You know, of course, this is derived from Plato. And it's funny that Dewey seems to think that this is, in some sense or another, applicable to all philosophy, not just the rationalists, not just the Platonists, but that, you know, he talks about Aristotle in this way. He talks about if you focus on sense data, you know, so that's something that's really far from a Platonic view, that what's really real is just red patch here. And that somehow, think of Wittgenstein's Tractatus, that we can build a world out of that kind of thing, logical atomism or something like this, that these are all hypostatizing the transient. They're abstracting from experience, either by saying that there's something behind experience, you know, a thing in itself that's motivating experience, that's unifying experience, or even taking a bit of experience itself, like red patch here, and saying that's the foundational elements of the world. And Dewey says there's no rational reason for this. It's really just an emotional reason. We can explain genetically, in other words, we can explain why people would have come to believe this. But really, there is no rationalization for any, like you were saying, Wes, that when we think of ontology, when we think of the levels of reality that things have, the levels of being, it just gets flattened out. Like there's just no, in his metaphysics, there's no room for that kind of gradation. So chapter 3 kind of gives the flip side of that, which is instead of just talking about the scary things, he wants to talk about human enjoyment. Human experience is preoccupied with enjoyment, that you could sort of go too far in giving functional analyses of things, like anthropologically, why did this native tribe have these customs? Or think about the way Freud talks about almost anything, because this behavior serves some deeper need. You know, that sounds like stuff that Dewey should buy, but he wants to make the point here that just doing things for the pure pleasure of it, for the immediate consummatory experience, what he calls, for an end in itself, that's a primary motivation.
Right. And that's prior to knowledge. And it's prior to labor, and where knowledge and labor focus on connections, this aesthetic is focused on these immediate experiences. And then he explains how this sort of conflation of the aesthetic and the rational, where you sort of hypostatize the, is that how you say it?
Hypostatize is the way I say it, but I don't.
Hypostatize, because I know you're going to send me an email correcting me if I don't correct it now. Hypostatize the object of immediate enjoyment as a transcendent reality. That's sort of what we get, where we get the metaphysics of form in Plato and Aristotle, which in turn forecloses the experimental, because what you get is this world of unchanging ends that are for the sake of stability, whereas science requires digging into the muck of the flux.
Yeah, and he has this is a long chapter, as all of them are, and has a few stories about the evolution of the view of ends, of teleology. The stuff about ends that we've already sort of stumbled into in this discussion so far is, I think, one of the hardest things in this whole book for me to understand.
Yeah.
And then chapter 4, though, is where he gets more into the not just nature as an end in itself, but turning the end into a means. It's about science, nature, means, and knowledge. And that's where he really gets into the character of intellectual meaning is instrumental, and what instrumentalism is.
So you take this experience, which is this absorbing aesthetic thing, and then you make that a tool for something else, which he talks about as sort of being a tool means to embody sequential bonds. In other words, you think of what it's good for, or you have predictions about what this does. He calls them predictive signs as well. And at that point, the thing you're experiencing becomes less of an aesthetic object. The aesthetic part weakens, and what you have before you is an instrumentality. Although he does talk a lot about how when we do labor and we use tools, we sort of pretty them up. We make them aesthetic in order to make work have that quality of the aesthetic.
Well, it's also part of the way objective relations are established. He says a tool is a particular thing. It possesses an objective relation as its own defining property. So one of the things that a tool does is define objects.
He calls them indices at one point. A tool is an indice of an index. So when we think about the objects of physics, for instance, they're a way of uniting appearances in a serial for the sake of control of nature and things like that. So objects in that sense, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So this is at the end of the third paragraph. He says, man's bias towards himself easily leads him to think of a tool solely in relation to himself, to his hand and eyes. But its primary relationship is toward other external things, as the hammer to the nail and the plow to the soil. Only through this objective bond does it sustain relation to man himself and his activities. A tool denotes a perception and acknowledgement of sequential bonds in nature. That I took to mean that objects themselves come out of this notion of sequential bonds in nature. In some ways, that's the way in which you get a whole that becomes an object. And maybe I'm reading more into it than that.
Yeah, I thought we had the immediate grasp of what we think of as objects. I thought we had an initial immediate grasp. And then,
in the sense that they're instrumental, all those objects are instrumental in some way. They come out of a series of causality that makes them objects for you. And in that way, he probably means something more particular by tool here, but the way in which objects arise, I took his to be very similar, the way he's talking about sequential bonds of nature in tools. Based on everything we've said so far in characterizing him, it seems very hard to say that somehow table presents itself as table immediately to our experience, right? Without at least saying a lot about how embedded it is. And then that embeddedness would seem to come along with a whole bunch of instrumentality, a whole bunch of series of causes that make it so that, okay, that's what I mean by table.
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying. I mean, I think this gets us back to the sense in which our experiences are theory-laden. I mean, I think he thinks
this
primary experience that is really is sort of devoid of this instrumentality. And now it's a question of, well, yeah, can we ever have that now of a table?
As soon as you talk about something as an object, then you are talking about it as something in a sequence of causes.
Exactly.
Where do you get that?
I'm just deriving that from what's just being said here.
That's the way I interpreted that section that I just read.
Yeah, I don't think so, but yeah.
As far as I understand his theory of education, so I actually listened to some of his Democracy in Education book. It's available as a LibriVox thing. Just sort of enough, the first several chapters, to kind of see how it matches with what we were reading. And the primary point of the book is just that people don't learn just by being told stuff. Don't just sit the kids in a classroom and tell them stuff. They learn through interacting. They learn through experimentation. So that's exactly in accordance with what we read here. So you might think that if you show a baby a table, like, the baby is not going to distinguish that table from anything else that's around it. It's only when the baby then starts pushing and shoving at the table and getting up on the table, doing things with the table, that the table gets distinguished as an object and as a table at all.
Well, there's nothing in this text, though, that says that.
Isn't that just what you were saying, Dylan, that you make the table into instead of just as an end, in other words, as a primal aesthetic experience, something that you're just contemplating, you make it into a means.
Mm-hmm.
You relate it to other fulfilling things. You know, you try little experiments with the table, you lean against it and feel its hardness.
I don't see that as the grounds for making it an object. There's no distinction for him. It's an object from the beginning. And I think you guys, I mean, I agree with you that you transform that object, that experience. Any of that stuff you do continually transforms it. But there's no problem with calling these raw, absorbing finalities, calling that an object of experience. I don't think he would make that distinction.
Or is it an event, the perceiving event that includes the object? And once you make the distinction between the event and the object, you're already doing some theory.
He very carefully avoids the word object, I think, through this whole thing.
He's going to have to have something to say at some point about the way in which some objects kind of leap out to us based upon their boundaries in time and space. He doesn't really talk in those terms, that the way in which we pull things out. He talks more in the way Mark was summarizing the process of coming up with an object, to me, rings almost directly in line with chapter 4 and his account of science and the process of science, of figuring things out and coming up with transforming the world into new kinds of objects. And it may be that there's more to say about that, that objects aren't simply that way. I mean, he could go two ways with it. He could say that just by our psychology and the way we experience the world, that we pull things out as objects, even though they're somehow even unnameable as to what they are, but they come out as individual wholes of some sort. And that is distinct from the process of generating objects, like the objects of science.
Well, the objects of science certainly are not part of the continuum, right? Those are the things that are not real in this sense. They are instrumental. They're models that have this instrumental value for the objects of experience, but they are not themselves objects in the same sense as objects of experience.
See, that's funny that I interpreted. So looking page 11, he talks about progress in science as coming up with more efficacious instrumentalities for dealing with the conditions of life and action. And the way that I read that was that he's actually putting tools like the telescope, so an actual object, and a concept like the molecule or whatever the thing the word molecule refers to, so the object molecule, and also methods for investigating, predictive scientific laws. These are all instrumentalities, that these are all objects in this sense. I didn't get the idea that, where did you find that he emphasizes that they're unreal?
Go to page 138. So to treat, therefore, the object of science, which in effect is the object of physics, as a complete and self-sufficient object, the end of knowing, is to burden ourselves with an unnecessary and insoluble problem. So the objects of science are not even objects of... There's a lot in this about how we grasp these immediacies, but that they're not knowledge, and then knowledge comes about with our scientific relation. But the point is that we can't reify the objects of physics. So because it commits us on the one side to a realm of immediately apparent things, the perceptual order, and on the other side to the... So what I'm trying to say is that this realm of experience is the real things, and the scientific models are not to be reified as real. They have this instrumental utility for dealing with the appearances, for managing experience, for getting better ends than we might otherwise get, endings, sorry, than we might otherwise get. But
I thought that was true of everything. It's not just true of science. And it all turns on this phrase right after the second hyphen, as complete and self-sufficient object. That's the part that he objects to.
Well, the immediacies are complete and self-sufficient.
Oh, I don't, that seems wrong.
Yeah, I don't, Mark.
Because he makes a big deal about how...
They depend on nothing else. So he makes it, but he talks about how they are ultimate.
Yes.
So that's the sense in which every one of those immediacies is a natural end. I'd have to find the exact text here.
I thought an end actually does imply
that
it is a manifestation of something that came before. That's what it means, that it's an ending, is that it's an appearance... In the sense that it is, I shouldn't even use the word appearance, but it's something that comes up, presents itself in experience as being the result of some past thing. So it's ultimate in that there's nothing in that experience where we're looking at it merely as a means and thinking about what's going to come next. We're appreciating it for what it is, not as a means to an end, but it is itself, is not self-sufficient in that it implies things before.
Yeah, so it's not the case that being a child is simply an unrealized adult. There is being a child, right? But it's not, that isn't all alone by itself either. It has a history to it. And it also, he wants to preserve it, has a potentiality to it. It has a way out and a way into it. And that's true of all things. And that's basically what an event is that to the extent that we call them, every event has a transitory nature to it. It has things coming in and things going out. It's a end and a means.
I thought the disagreement here was about what he's calling the real. So he's denying reification to these scientific models, but I don't think he would deny reification to what's in primary experience. Those are by definition reified.
Well, I don't think he's privileging objects as being real.
I think he is, yeah.
The immediate objects, Wes is saying.
Yeah, immediate objects of experience is real, yeah. There are scientific objects, but those are just objects in a derivative sense. We're speaking loosely when we call those objects.
And then we're brought back to the question of where is the line between quote-unquote immediate objects of experience and these other things. To me, I read him as that there may be a way in which that line moves along where things that were once not immediate objects of experience become immediate objects of experience because of their embeddedness. That's how I was reading him. So in the way in which a table is an object is not, it might be an immediate object of experience at some point, but it's not that way until you bring in the causal structure to make it so.
I think you're right in the sense that before you are aware of its instrumentality, it's not a table in the definitional sense, right? But the immediacy part comes in this object that we call a table and that where we, of course, have in mind all its instrumentalities. Someone completely naive of that, say an infant, could just have the immediate experience. So you see what I'm saying?
But they wouldn't have an immediate experience of a table.
They would have an immediate experience of that thing. This is not a real distinction we're making. This is the sense and reference problem. I'm talking about the thing itself, not the descriptive connotations of the word table.
I understand, but this is what I was talking about before as maybe it's all in that phrase that you're calling the immediate objects of experience, but the way in which we break the world up into things that are this and that here and now along some kind of set of boundaries that are quote unquote natural, but also have to do with the way in which we process the world. So they end up being things and objects that are separable in some way. I would agree that those would somehow constitute immediate objects of experience without having any instrumentality associated with them.
So I think our frustration with Dewey is that he kind of promises in this empiricism, in this naturalistic empiricism, it sounds like he's going to do something like phenomenology. He almost says to the things themselves, like he doesn't want philosophy to get too theoretical. He wants it to pay attention to concrete things. But then he doesn't give a lot of individual example. He doesn't actually do the normal thing you would do in epistemology and like, now I'm contemplating the table and what can I say about is it a table or it is not a table and how do I know it's there? You know, he doesn't play that game.
He hardly talks about tables at all, even though we spent the past half an hour talking about
he
tables.
He does talk about a chair.
Okay.
Can we find where he actually talks about the chair?
It's on 18.
Oh, he says an author writes. Oh, this is page 16. I'm sorry. I just searched on chair.
No, yeah. So in 18, he's talking about how it's not reducible to sense data because that would be reducing an experience to the property of the act of experiencing.
Well, yeah, but the reason he's doing this is because he's brought this up on page 16 in the context of a view he's arguing against. That he says the kind of epistemology that I hate.
Right.
And he doesn't even like the word epistemology. He uses theory of inquiry or experimental logic, or actually the words he uses according to the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy.
So someone else gives the example of the chair being reducible to sense data. Two points are involved in any such statement. One is that experience is reduced to the traits connected with the act of experiencing, in this case, the act of sensing. Certain patches of color, for example, assume a certain shape or form in connection with qualities connected with the muscular strains and adjustments of seeing. These qualities, which define the act of seeing when it is made an object of reflective inquiry, over against what is seen, thus become the chair itself for immediate or direct experience. So, yes, it's the table itself that you see. It's not that you build it up out of sense data.
Yep.
And then where does he take that?
If we ever get back to this total chair, it will not be the chair of direct experience, of use and enjoyment, a thing with its own independent origin, history, and career. It will only be a complex of directly given sense qualities.
But so you're right. What we experience in primary experience is the chair with its uses and history and all that stuff picked out as, does he use the word object here? But certainly there's no problem with calling it an object. It's just not in that sense an object of science. Or is it?
The object of experience are things like tables.
Mm-hmm.
But as Dylan is right, you know, we might not see a table as a table in the strict sense of if we're naive enough. But it's that thing, though, we can have this primary experience of it.
Yeah, and this chair of direct experience, just reading what his opinion is, what his claim is in the middle of that last sentence, the chair of direct experience is one of use, of enjoyment, a thing with its own independent origin, history, and career.
So now I'm beginning to think Dylan has a good point here. But I don't think it's Dewey's point.
I'll put it on my calendar, Wes.
Because I don't think you can get a primary experience with all this use and enjoyment part of it without it already having been transformed by its relationship to utility.
Yeah, because that's what learning is. So anybody that could be having this conversation has already bitten from the tree of knowledge, so to speak.
Exactly.
Yeah, but he doesn't talk about any of this.
What Mark just said is a direct quote.
From somewhere in some other context.
Yeah, it's in the fourth chapter.
No, it has nothing to do with this issue. To talk about the Garden of Eden, that's where he's talking about labor is, you know, it's the beginning of the labor chapter where, you know, labor is traditionally thought of as laborious.
No, but the idea of that you've already, when knowledge is already bitten.
He's not using that example for that point.
No, he is not using that example here. You're right.
But the labor chapter is, the point of that is it's a genetic account of how we get objects of science. That mm-hmm. the reason yeah. that we would investigate these kind of things is because we want to do something with the table, because we have labor. We want to eat off of it. So we have to do experiments.
No, the better example for science, though, is, you know, you have these elements, for instance, which are just aesthetic objects, you know, gases or something like that. And then you can begin to do experiments that create these sequential orders. So, for instance, Dalton with the development of atomic theory, where you say, okay, if I combine oxygen and carbon, I can use like 133 grams of oxygen for 100 grams of carbon, or 266. And so I see these discrete weights combining, and then I come up with atomic theory because I know it's not continuous, that they're just these discrete combinations that will give me CO or CO2, a thing like that. So I can start out in a very, very naive position with these appearances, which will become the elements of science by creating these causal sequences, by instrumentalizing them. So that's all I'm saying with the whole primary aesthetic experience. The table is a more complex example.
Wouldn't the corresponding thing with the table be you could contemplate a tree aesthetically, and insofar as you're just stuck on, you know, maybe you're a tree worshiping society, as far as you're just stuck on that, then you do not advance. And as soon as you are able to put that aside, put aside your eulogizing and aesthetically experiencing the tree, to think what you can do with the tree, the fact that you can, well, what if I chop it down? What if I cut the pieces up? What if I make something? Hey, that works pretty well to hold my food up.
Yeah, although I think he would think more paradigmatically, figure out how the tree works, figure out that there are cells, because I think we don't want to limit this idea of practicality to this idea that, oh, you can make tables out of trees. The instrumentality is more about the way in which I can be predictive. That's the instrumentality part. I can come up with some theory that's explanatory in this case, that is also explanatory of future events, future phenomena. So that's the utility. It's not just, oh, I can create technologies with this or stuff that's useful.
Well, that's an interesting connection that he sketches out at some length, I thought, between what you're talking about is just being able to predict. So that's sort of close to pure science, you know, to really just know something for him is still going to be to know how it interacts with other things, to know how to predict its behavior. It's still applied in a certain way, but it gives a genetic account then of, well, the reason, you know, we have that ethic of science, the reason that we've developed the methods is because of survival, because of fear, because of labor that we had to do to survive, you know, for actually very concrete, lowbrow, instrumental things. But he does want to say, unlike, it's one of the common criticisms of pragmatism, that surely you can't just say that the truth is just what personally benefits you or something. And this is kind of what he wraps up chapter 4 with, is railing against this kind of unfortunate association of the practical with the commercial,
yeah,
or the self-serving. That no, practical just means you're trying to accomplish something.
Also, he rejects the idea that an inquirer should be motivated only by practical application, only by, hey, I'm going to create a technology with this. So he gives both the commercial thing and this whole motive thing. This is on page 164.
Well, but he says that and this reminded me of Nietzsche's On Truth and Lie, of why would we have a passion for truth? Well, it's because of a moral,
yes,
thing, according to Dewey.
Yep.
So it itself, anything that's moral, is really an ultimately practical thing, you know, like our preference for the settled over the precarious.
Yeah, so this confused me. What would then be a non-applied science? Because he's saying that applied sciences are better. And then he's saying it's understandable that people wouldn't think applied sciences are better because of this association with the idea that the motive should only be practical application or that it should be commercial. But he never, as far as I can tell, clearly says what the difference between, because if you think in this broad sense, everything is an applied science, right? The way you just talked about it, Mark.
I mean, I thought at that point he was doing a kind of conventional applied, civil engineering is an applied science kind of thing, as opposed to trying to figure out the nature of light.
Yeah, that's the way I took it. But then when Mark was talking about this more general way of taking applied, how do we reconcile that?
Well, I thought that he was spending a lot of time trying to say that applied sciences are no problem. I took that as dovetailing with the idea that in some ways all sciences are applied in the sense of trying to solve problems and pragmatic in that respect. Even though you may have the desire to try to solve the problems for the sake of solving the problems, not for the sake of a commercial interest or for trying to heat your house or something like that. You could be motivated by solving them aesthetically.
So he says on page 161, what is sometimes termed applied science may then be more truly science than what is conventionally called pure science. For it is directly concerned not with just instrumentalities, but instrumentalities at work and affecting modifications of existence in behalf of conclusions that are reflectively preferred. This means that you're right about it being something like civil engineering or something like that. It means applied in our conventional sense of applied. Because the reflectively preferred just means we want to do something with it. And he wants to make this distinction between applied and pure. So I don't think we can just think of every science as applied in some broad sense. That's not, he's trying to make a distinction here.
Well, in fact, he says at page 163, he goes into, and 162 is the distinction between application and then pure science.
So he's only saying that about, you know, that applied science is more truly science because he's spent this whole chapter telling us the definition of a scientific object, that a scientific object is an instrumentality. So explicitly practical investigation into a technology is more truly doing what science by its definition sets out to do.
But he does, you know, in 163, he gets to the point where he wants to justify the idea that history and anthropology, which are not typically even considered sciences, are actually applied sciences. So,
right. So the very last sentence of the entire chapter, the genuine interests of pure science are served only by broadening the idea of application to include all phases of liberation and enrichment of human experience. So that's why I was saying that it's,
I see.
Just wanting to know for knowledge's sake is something that ultimately has a moral and thus practical bent, not necessarily because it's charitable or something like that, but we think it's part of the good life, part of virtue, something like this, to satisfy curiosity, to deepen our knowledge of all things. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just only if we lose track of where that motivation came from, that it comes from fundamental human needs, and not just, you know, like we're hitting on what God meant for us to do or something like that. For pure science sake, the way his culture normally takes it, I think he would see as some sort of abstraction, some bastardization in the same way that he objects to most other kinds of philosophy here.
Yeah, in discussing the paragraph that starts with pure science, where he's trying to link them, go back to applied sciences, if we could free ourselves of a somewhat abject notion, it would be clear enough that what makes any proposition scientific is its power to yield understanding, insight, intellectual at-homeness in connection with any existential state of affairs by filling events with coherent and tested meanings. In fact, he puts pure and applied in quotes, which now more than ever made me think that those are adjectives which he thinks are misplaced, that are based upon baggage that we have on these things, and that it's all really just science. It's all about yielding understanding, insight, and intellectual at-homeness.
Yes, and ultimately science is continuous with any kind of inquiry, with what he wants philosophy to be.
Yes.
Everyday kind of, you know, where did I leave my keys? There's that kind of inquiry. It's all, the difference between them is just the amount of sophistication that's involved in those secondary reflective objects that are involved that
yes.
you don't bring great things to bear in finding your keys.
There's no quantum field theory equations to solve.
Unless you think that they have slipped into an alternate reality.
A wormhole. Some kind of... We might have to bust out some equations.
You don't think you could have an interesting inquiry into where your keys are?
You can write that up as a blog post. We'll see how many people...
The counterfactuals involved and the, yeah.
Well, this seems like a good place to end part one of the discussion.
Thanks for listening to part one of this episode of The Partially Examined Life. You can listen to part two immediately and ad-free if you become a PEL citizen at partiallyexaminedlife.com/membership. Membership also gives you unlimited ad-free access to all episodes and a host of other bonus content, available from a single, convenient fee that you can use with a variety of podcast apps. And membership makes you part of our Not School community, which features discussion groups with other listeners and, on occasion, your PEL hosts. Other ways to provide support include making a donation, purchasing merchandise, or giving us a cut of your Amazon purchases by using the link on our homepage.